I think we're morally justified to resort to whatever means are necessary in order to defend our land from destruction. Invasion. I see this as an invasion.
Welcome to Sacred Land Speaks, where we dive into the audio archives of the Sacred Land Film Project and revisit the interview clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we bring you my rare interview with the renowned, reclusive, rabble-rousing author, Edward Abbey. When I moved to Berkeley in the late 1970s, I read Edward Abbey's eco-thriller novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang. At the time, within our wrecking ball of a culture, I'd say Abbey was as close as I could come to a real teacher. I'd been hanging around some wise Native American leaders, and Ed Abbey was the white man's version of a wise elder. He perceived the spirit of the land, defended special places like the canyons and deserts of the Colorado Plateau, and eloquently urged the burgeoning environmental movement to recognize the sacred power of nature. Abbey died in 1989, and let's say it at the outset, he was a product of the patriarchy. Some of his writing about Native Americans and immigrants is offensive, and feminists have appropriately judged him harshly. But in this hour, we're focusing on Abbey as an early defender of public lands, who encouraged resistance to industry's destruction of what he called wilderness and what I would call land, water, air, and wildlife that are respected or held in reverence by humans. In the spring of 1981, I was preparing for a film trip for our Four Corners documentary, and I wrote Abbey a letter requesting an interview. He sent back a plain white postcard that contained the letters OK and his phone number. I called him at the beginning of what was to be a six-week marathon film shoot and asked if he'd be up on the Colorado Plateau anytime soon for the interview. Abbey replied, "Meet me at Lone Rock Campground, 9 miles north of Glen Canyon Dam on the spring equinox. We have something planned." Okay. I arrived on the shores of Lake Powell with my film partners, Glenn Switkus and Randy Hayes, before Abbey got there. Showing up with a bunch of electronic film gear led Abbey's compatriots to peg us for FBI agents. I would only learn a few days later that the 7 desert rats we met gathered around a campfire and a few cases of beer were the founders of Earth First, and they were about to stage their first guerrilla theater direct action. This real-life monkey wrench gang softened a bit when Glenn offered everyone bottles of his home-brewed beer. But their suspicions continued until Abbey showed up a few days later and said, "Relax, they're my film crew. I invited them." For those of you who haven't read the book, the number one goal of Abbey's fictional gang was to blow up Glen Canyon Dam, the 710-foot-high concrete monstrosity that they hated, thereby draining what they called Lake Fowl, freeing the Colorado River, and letting nature restore 180 miles of spectacular Red Rock Canyon, which they considered to be sacred land. As is true of many authors, Ed Abbey was a reluctant interviewee, but he agreed to an audio pre-interview on the night before whatever the something was that his friends had planned. Sitting in the passenger seat of our van as the wind howled outside, I was curious to learn how he developed his view of the world.
I've lived in the Southwest since 47. It's almost 34 years now. I've seen the cities grow immensely. I went to school at University of New Mexico, Albuquerque, which was a small city of maybe 35,000 people when I went there in 48. Now, I guess there are 400,000 living there. Better than a tenfold increase in those 30-odd years. I've seen industrialization spread all over the West, of course, power plants and dams and strip mines, highway projects, nuclear power plants underway or already built. Certainly I've seen a lot of changes in these mere 34 years, almost every one of which I disapprove of, being a reactionary, I guess. Like to turn the clock back.
Of the many insults he'd named, I asked him to describe what he thought was the biggest threat we face.
I don't consider myself an expert at any of these things. I'm just a writer, an entertainer, who made the mistake of falling in love with the American West a little too late. I should have been born a century earlier, I guess. I feel a little foolish trying to talk about these huge subjects. All I have are ordinary citizens' opinions. I certainly don't consider myself an authority on these things. I suppose if I were to try to draw back far enough, take the biggest, longest possible view, I would say that human beings are basically biological. We are animals like others, and we tend to expand our numbers to the very limit of our range and then a little beyond. This has happened before in human history. Empires have risen and fallen, probably because of economic causes. Too many people trying to make a living off a limited amount of land. We can see this quite clearly in small situations. For example, a Navajo nation on their little reservation, population growing so fast, from 15,000 in 1890 to about 150,000 today, I guess. Land disputes with the Hopis, and attempts to expand beyond the reservation, meeting solid wall of resistance, because there's simply no room. Gross unemployment within the reservation, something like 50 or 60%, so I've heard. That's the long view, the biological view. And there are social and political ways of looking at it, of course. And so my life looks like it's going to span a transition period from a pre-industrial West to a very industrial West. I don't know what'll happen in the meantime. Maybe the economy will slow down enough to retard all these various industrial projects. I certainly hope so.
At that point, I chimed in that it seemed to me that technology was the biggest problem.
All these things seem to work together. Technology, government, population pressure, economic drives, profit incentive. I guess the same sort of thing is happening in other industrial nations all over the world. I don't think it matters so much whether they call themselves socialist or capitalist anymore. I think all big industrial societies have this built-in need to expand, to grow. Therefore, inevitably, they come into conflict with other nations or other empires, the Soviet Empire versus the American Empire. And they come into conflict with their own people, with their own land, through this attempt to exploit everything as intensively as possible and as rapidly as possible. I think there's something about the combination of technology and industrialism and militarism that leads to this apparently insatiable desire for power, domination, and growth. Growth means power, power means growth. They reinforce each other, stimulate each other.
I asked what he thought we should do instead of pursuing perpetual growth.
Another deep philosophical question. Well, I think stewardship is certainly a better idea than simply exploitation for immediate and temporary profit. But stewardship, too, is based on the assumption that the earth and everything on it exists for the benefit of humankind. Therefore, I don't find it an adequate approach to the world. I'd prefer to assume that everything on this planet has a right to exist for its own sake, to continue to exist. Even inanimate objects, rocks and rivers, and certainly all forms of life, plant and animal, I think have some inherent right to exist and go on existing. I don't know how to defend that attitude philosophically. That's all it is, an attitude, but that's what I feel rather deeply. Stewardship, I think, implies management and thereby human management of the entire planet, everything on it. It's a European idea. René Dubos wooing the earth, the managerial attitude toward nature. That's another aspect of stewardship. Even wilderness is regarded as a resource. Everything is a resource, which means everything is to be used in some way, however benevolently, primarily for human advantage, human pleasure, human recreation, perhaps, or human profit. And I think we've got to find our way to some different point of view. Somehow we've got to transcend our human limitations and achieve a, as you could call it, a transhuman point of view, a recognition, acknowledgement of the existence of other things and their right to existence. There are people working on this problem, this philosophical problem. I don't know how to defend it in any logical, coherent way right now.
This concept, which we now refer to as the rights of nature, that everything has an innate right to exist, was a pretty new idea at the time. I like to think that Edward Abbey would be happy that it's become mainstream today. I asked about the effectiveness of his work, the impact of his writing.
I've made a living at it. Been effective in that way. Some people seem to like it, but I have no way of measuring what effect it has had on events. If any, I doubt if it's had much effect. People who write books and people who read books generally are not very effective in the short run, I suspect. I think ideas make a big difference in the long run over the centuries, but it takes ideas a long time to germinate and grow into something with any strength. I don't know any way you can measure that effectiveness. I think it makes a difference. I think it's best to resist to the best of our ability. I'm against passive non-resistance. I think we still have obligations as citizens to concern ourselves with what's happening in our communities and regions and nation. And a way of life is being threatened. The old agrarian way of life is certainly threatened here in the West. Farming, ranching communities are going to be wiped out, I think, if this military and industrial machine rolls over them. I think most people feel a conflict within themselves in these matters. They welcome the idea of industrial development insofar as it seems to promise jobs for their children and for themselves, more economic security perhaps for their communities. At the same time, they fear rapid growth or uncontrolled growth and the influx of thousands or hundreds of thousands of strangers into their communities. So I think most people are of a divided mind on these matters. I mean, most of the people who live out here have lived out here all their lives. That's the majority. Then you have loud minorities on either end, for and against. Pro-industrial interests have most of the power on their side. Political power, governmental power, money power. I don't think it's hopeless, of course. I think eventually the military-industrial state will collapse and we'll return to some sort of agrarian society, maybe a hunting and gathering society.
While Abbey was cagey about his direct involvement, he is credited with inspiring the radical environmental group Earth First, a real incarnation of his Monkey Wrench Gang, which, soon after this interview, unbeknownst to me and my film crew, was about to go public with a performative act of civil disobedience on the hated Glen Canyon Dam. I asked Abbey if he felt there was widespread support for his efforts at environmental protection.
I think there's a lot of support for the idea of conservation and preservation, yes, and probably gradually growing support. But that support has not been growing fast enough to counteract industrial trends, retard them maybe, slow them down a little, but certainly not stop them or reverse them. This is typical anyway. People begin to prize things only when they realize they may lose them. When I first came to the Southwest in 47, why? I didn't have any more foresight as to what was going to happen to anyone else. I took it for granted that the country would remain largely open and free indefinitely. I suppose the Glen Canyon Dam, building of that in the late 50s, was the first shocker to me when I realized that there were some people abroad running loose who really determined to change things quite drastically here in the West. I think that's when I first began to realize that everything that I loved about the West was in great danger. How many people feel that way now? What they're going to do about it? I don't know. As you know, there are dozens of conservation organizations with hundreds of thousands of members. Until recently, we seemed to have a great deal of political power, but that was lost last fall, at least temporarily. I think there's still basic support for conservation. I'm sure there is. Majority support, probably. I think Reagan was elected mainly because people couldn't stand Jimmy Carter anymore. He was just such a bore and so inept. And people, the 27% of the eligible voters who voted for Reagan probably did so hoping that he would do something about unemployment and inflation. I don't think he has any mandate to undo all the conservation and environmental laws of the last 10 years. In fact, I can't see that he has much of a mandate to do anything.
In many ways, four decades later, it feels like history is repeating itself. We replaced Carter with Biden and Reagan with Trump. Abby says change takes a long time.
Human beings are very adaptable. We've seen kind of life they will adapt to in India, China, and Europe. So I'm afraid the same sort of thing could well happen in North America, that the old ideals of wilderness and physical freedom will gradually be lost. Surrendered. People will forget what they were like and no longer prize them. I think the U.S. is well on its way to being Europeanized right now. Hardly a square foot of American soil that's not being exploited for some sort of commercial or industrial purpose. Even the national parks, to a great extent, are part of the industrial commercial system, part of the tourism industry. Therefore, the automotive industry, steel and oil. Well, I think for the short run, things look kind of bleak. For the long run, it'll take 100 years or so, maybe some drastic changes. Unless we go about these changes in some intelligent and rational way, why, they'll also be very painful for most of us, I imagine.
I asked Ed Abbey what he thought it takes for people to develop intimacy with a place, love for the land, and how best to protect it from the destructive forces he described so well in his writing.
I suppose people have to know a place or a way of life pretty well before they can care about it. In fact, they have to participate in it, have a part in it. I don't suppose that people will simply tour the West as tourists and look at things from a distance will learn to love what people who live out here have learned to love. I think that kind of love, love of the land, love of the kind of freedom that open land gives you, is something that can only be learned through experience, maybe suggested through books. From what I hear, some things I've written have lured a few people west from the cities and helped lead to the overcrowding of the West. But generally, people don't care much about things they're not familiar with. They care about things they are familiar with and things that are causing them problems, and that's perfectly understandable. On the other hand, we can see that most of the support for conservation and wilderness comes from Eastern legislators and California, Pacific Coast legislators. So it's probably also true that people learn to appreciate most what they no longer have or have very little of. I think it's important to try to keep the tradition alive of what life in the American West has been and still is, and resist to the best of our ability those things that are going to destroy it. Delaying actions, rear guard actions, until something more basic changes. Probably the economy will save us if anything does. Inflation, which I see as caused primarily by the depletion of resources and the misallocation of resources. Too much of the natural wealth going into the military and not enough into real human needs. That surely is one of the basic causes of inflation. And as everything becomes more expensive, people are going to be forced to adapt to a somewhat simpler, more frugal way of life. Probably have fewer children. I think that's already going on. Somebody wrote a book called Muddling Toward Frugality. California professor, was it Warren Johnson, is that his name?
I think so.
And his outlook is pretty much more hopeful than mine. He thinks that things will change gradually. Our economy will become more simple. People will not only adapt to a frugal style of living, but will learn to like it and prefer it. I hope he's right. I hope things develop along the lines that he predicts.
In spite of the many threats and wounds he chronicled, Abbey was actually optimistic about the future of the American West because of the scarcity of a key life-giving resource.
I don't think the entire West is going to be destroyed by industrialization. It's just going to be greatly diminished. I think there will probably always be plenty of open space left in the West. I don't think it can ever be densely settled and populated the way Europe is, for example, simply because of the lack of water. Unless they really do divert the Columbia and the Yukon into the West, which has been proposed, of course, or start towing gigantic icebergs up from Antarctica, pulling them up the Gulf of California, maybe, and up the Colorado River to Yuma. Desalination. The West is very fortunate in being an arid area. So no matter how ruthlessly it's exploited in the next 10 or 20 years, I don't think it will ever be as densely populated as Eastern America or Latin America or Europe. Not unless we enter some kind of super technological planetary state with unlimited power and infinite exploitation of all resources. That's imaginable, I suppose. I guess people like Buckminster Fuller and Teilhard de Chardin can envision such a world, supporting maybe 10 or 20 billion people instead of the what we have now, 4 or 5 billion. I suppose humans can adapt to it. They'll adapt to anything, but within limits.
So we were making a documentary film. Earth Firsters were busy outside our van plotting their theatrical direct action protest. And I asked Abbey what his personal strategy was and what his advice was for people who want to make a difference.
Well, my strategy is just go home and try to write another funny book. I think people, all those who care, are morally obliged to resist in whatever way they can, whatever way they're best at. It's a kind of campaign or war that is so huge in extent, none of us can take part in all of it or even follow events in all of it. So each of us has to choose a sector of the front to participate in, decide what you care about most, and get involved in that. I think life is much more enjoyable when you're participating, involving yourself in something a little bigger than yourself or something outside of yourself. I think the worst thing a human being can do, even a writer, is to retreat into himself, and crawl into his corner and stay there, just issue a book now and then. That's not good enough. That's why I come to events like this. It'd be so much easier just to stay behind the typewriter and pound away, but I'm afraid if I did it that way all the time, I'd soon become completely out of touch with the real world.
Abbey saw the real world in which large organizations inevitably crush individual liberty. His 1956 master's thesis was titled Anarchism and the Morality of Violence. And throughout his life, he described himself as an anarchist.
I think rebelliousness and skepticism are healthy attitudes, yes. And that human beings should always be wary of human institutions. I think there's something about our institutions which bring out the worst in us. Governments and big businesses and military organizations. Somehow, it seems to me, combine the worst rather than the best features of human beings. Perhaps because a big organization enables us to shuck off personal responsibility. And therefore, big organizations can commit crimes and do monstrous things that human beings as individuals might think of doing but would hardly dare attempt to do and would certainly not have the capability of doing alone or in small groups. There's nothing like a great, venerable institution for behaving like a hysterical mob. I think you can see that in government's behavior every day. I think we should try to simplify and decentralize our institutions, all of them, all the time. That should be a constant effort of human beings. Surely the evidence is pretty good by now that whenever we organize ourselves in a large scale groups, why, we do more harm than good. We start building pyramids and pentagons and Kremlins, concentration camps, trips to the moon, and the Pentagon should be financed by voluntary contributions only, not by compulsory taxation.
Abby worried that things were going to get worse before they got better.
I suspect that the battles are going to be more intense and bitter in the years ahead. And I'm afraid that if our economic troubles continue, that most people will naturally become so concerned about simply survival, preserving as much of their own standard of living as they can, that environmental values will be forced into second place. That's what I'm afraid of. In other words, that America will become more like Europe, in which every square foot of Earth's surface is used for human purposes. Tramways at the top of every mountaintop, dams in every river. Well, maybe a prosperous, booming economy would be the worst thing that can happen to the American West, at least. It's hard to say. It seems to be dangers either way. Hardship and misery either way. I think another economic boom, such as we had in the 50s, would give us maybe short-term relief from unemployment, perhaps, but lead in the long term to just compounding of all the problems we're struggling with now. Compounding and worsening. Be far more people with far more needs trying to make a living off the same finite patch of earth. And we tend to become more and more like the Navajo Nation. Except that there's no bigger nation around us which is willing to support us with a welfare system.
I was trying to get at Abby's ideal vision of human society, whether he thought technology and industry could be compatible with wilderness, and he frequently pushed back on my questions.
Oh, God, what a question. All these questions are too difficult. They all suggest almost an infinite number of answers and complexities. Well, I've lived in Europe, and I've lived in the East, and I've lived in cities, and I've lived on a farm, and I've lived out in the wilderness. I've lived in small towns. And I think what I prize above everything else is diversity or variety in ways of life and types of landscape and kinds of people. And I think the greatest threat of technology and industrialism is the tendency it has to homogenize everything, to constrain everything within one pattern. I see a tendency towards a planetary economy and a planetary technology, perhaps a very benign, benevolent one, ruled by benevolent computers, in which everybody would have enough to eat, and all basic needs would be satisfied. But there would not be much variety in ways of living or in kinds of people. There would not be much real personal freedom. This is, of course, an old familiar nightmare foreseen by people like Orwell and Aldous Huxley and other anti-utopians. I cannot imagine anything very good about a technological utopia unless it were somehow restricted to just parts of the planet. I'd have no objection at all to industrialism and technology if we somehow had the ability and the willingness to restrict these activities to just small parts of the planet. I'd like to see beautiful and brilliant cities scattered over the planet, places where people would come together for great ceremonies and festivals, the arts, and their politics. But each of these great glowing cities should be surrounded by first a belt of farmland where the food is grown to support these cities, and then beyond that, something more approximating wilderness, an untouched natural world where humans would go only to visit or to explore or to have adventures or get lost, but would not settle, at least not in big groups, at least not with the support from the central industrial system. I suppose that would be my notion of a utopia. But people survive in all sorts of situations, and I think humans will survive the military industrial onslaught of the next 10 or 50 years, I doubt if it can last much longer than that without self-destructing. In the meantime, everywhere, anywhere, people go on leading their lives somehow, although it's easy to think of plenty of exceptions to that. When life does become unendurable and people revolt, things have to get very bad before people will rebel. And that's understandable, too. And rebellion is so risky, dangerous, threatening, unknown terrors, of which death is only the lesser ones, perhaps. How did I get onto that subject?
Randy, Glenn, and I were there to film coal strip mines and power plants, abandoned piles of radioactive uranium mill waste, and giant transmission lines marching across the desert, to visually tell the story of the hidden costs of America's relentless pursuit of energy. At the end of this pre-interview, I was surprised to hear about Abby's hope for the future.
God, the American people are such a strange entity. I don't know what it is or what we are, but I still have some hope. In fact, I believe that the majority of people have more common sense than our so-called leaders. And I do think that if our democracy were allowed to work, or if we made it work, that we as a whole, as a majority, would make more intelligent decisions than our industrialists and politicians are making. I still have some hope that people will get angry enough to demand some real, sensible changes in our society and the way things that are done. Perhaps Reagan will be good in that respect. The energy crisis is a moral crisis. Maybe I better stop there. That sounds pretty good.
I like that.
After our late-night interview in the van, we hiked with Abby to the edge of Glen Canyon, and with the wind still blowing hard and the loathsome dam looming behind him, we got a rare, on-camera interview with the famous author. I picked up where we'd left off in the van and asked him to explain why he felt the energy crisis is a moral crisis.
I think the energy crisis is a moral crisis because it reveals a lack of sensitivity to the rights of other living creatures, the birds and the animals and the plants. It reveals a kind of greediness on the part of human beings to exploit everything for their own immediate use, even when it endangers our own existence in the long run. That's why I would call it a moral crisis. I think it's a failure of moral sensitivity, a failure to recognize the rights of other living things and non-living things.
Standing with a bottle of beer in his hand and the wind threatening to blow his well-worn cowboy hat into the canyon below, Abby railed against everything the dam represented.
The American West is mostly power development, coal, uranium, hydroelectric power. I think it's a threat because I think the American nation has been over-industrialized already. I think we're way out of balance. Something like 2% of the American land has been preserved as wilderness. That doesn't seem fair to me. I think it should be more like 50-50. 50% wilderness, 50% commercial industrial development.
I asked him to expand on what was threatened by industrialization.
Oh, human freedom, first of all. The kind of open space that the American West still offers, national forests, public lands, national parks, are essential to human freedom, personal liberty, and to the right of other creatures, animals and plants, to exist, to live their own lives as they wish.
Because we were filming now, I asked again about his long view of human life in Western North America.
Well, this part of the world has been inhabited, apparently, for about 20,000 years by immigrants from Asia who lived mostly in a hunting and gathering society. Their population never grew very large, and therefore they did not make much of an impact on the land. Although they made some, they eliminated a few species of large mammals, like the mastodons, tapirs, a few others I could think of. And then about 150 years ago, the Europeans moved in, and their impact on the land has been much more drastic. They've been trying to develop it and exploit it very rapidly, very intensively, in order to support a rapidly growing human population. And the result of this process has been to eliminate many species of wild animals, destroy much of the native habitat, and if it continues, it threatens the existence of human beings as well in this country. We're just eating ourselves out of house and home. We're destroying our land base, that which supports us, sacrificing farmland and rangeland, grazing land to mineral development, power development, mining. It's a self-destructive process. It's very successful in the short term for a century or two, but I'm certain that it's going to lead to a large-scale disaster, that the land will not be able to support an ever-growing human population and an ever more intensive industrialization.
As we struggled to record good quality sound on the windy canyon rim, with the hum of electric transmission towers in the distance, Abby warmed up a bit and grew impassioned about the landscape he had grown to love.
Despite all these weird structures in the foreground, it's just a place of great grandeur and spaciousness, color, mystery, and I think it offers an ultimate form of human freedom. I think human beings really need physical space, room to move about without colliding with one another and human institutions all the time. I think we need space. I think it's one of the basic freedoms, open space, lots of room. One human being per square mile, that should be the optimum human population for a free nation.
Isn't that utopian or idealistic or romantic? Is there any chance?
Oh yeah, it's utopian, idealistic, and romantic. And I think also quite natural, a realistic demand. I don't want to live in a European kind of society, and even less so in an Asiatic kind of society. I think most Americans feel the way I do when they really think about it, or really feel about it. This kind of open country and physical freedom, political freedom, intellectual freedom all go together in the long run. And it offers us the kind of diversity that I most admire in the human society, life on Earth. More the merrier.
I asked if he thought political opposition had any chance of stopping the steamroller of industrialization.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I don't know. I imagine it helps to slow it down. I'm in favor of anything that retards it, slows it down, delays it. If it came to a real crisis or showdown between opposing forces, I don't think the environmentalists would have the chance of a snowball in hell. I'm sure the industrial system and the military component would get together and do what they want to do anyway.
Edward Abbey's classic novel, The Monkey Wrench Gang, tells the story of a group of activists who cut down billboards, pull up survey stakes, and pour sugar in the gas tanks of the machines that are tearing up their beloved desert. The Monkey Wrencher's code of ethics joyfully endorses violence against machines and concrete, but prohibits harming human beings. Nobody gets hurt as the eco-warriors sabotage the industrial machinery they deem guilty of environmental destruction. The way they see it, they're defending their home, their family, their kin. As Abby stood in front of the hated dam and its crackling transmission lines, I asked if he still thought monkey wrenching was an appropriate response to the rape of the West.
I think we're morally justified to resort to whatever means are necessary in order to defend our land from destruction. Invasion. I see this as an invasion. These look like creatures from Mars to me. I feel no kinship with that fantastic structure over there. No sympathy with it whatsoever. Yeah, I would advocate sabotage, subversion, as a last resort when political means fail.
While it wasn't an act of sabotage, the Earth First action that followed unfolded like a military operation. Back in camp, there were cryptic logistical discussions over breakfast. The vibe was somewhere between tight security and laissez-faire. We agreed to find a good location downstream of the dam to film whatever they had planned. A few hours later, I set up my camera on the bridge that spans Glen Canyon and aimed the lens toward the towering dam. And then, off to the west, came four men shuffling down an access road and hauling a heavy black tube out onto the dam. I filmed as they raised the cylinder to the edge and then unfurled a roll of black plastic that stretched 200 feet down, thereby cracking the face of the odious dam in a classic guerrilla theater stunt. I got the shot, which would become the climax of my first short film, The Cracking of Glen Canyon Dam. Meanwhile, a crowd had gathered in the visitor center parking lot, and we filmed as Ed Abbey climbed into the back of an old green pickup truck and delivered a stem winder of a speech.
This earth was not created for human use alone. All creatures, great and small, animal and plant, have the inherent, basic, self-evident right to exist, to be, to live out their lives in their own manner, to produce posterity and pursue happiness in their own individual ways. Humans must learn this lesson before we can change that human life is a part and only a part of the great web of life, and that all life depends first and foremost upon the preservation of a livable earth. What is the use of building a great city if you haven't got a tolerable planet to build it on? Earth first. How can we create a civilization fit for the dignity of free men and women if the globe itself is ravaged and polluted and defiled and insulted? The domination of nature leads to the domination of human beings. Meanwhile, what to do? Here I can offer nothing but more of the same. Oppose the destruction of our homeland by these alien forces from Houston, Tokyo, Manhattan, Washington, D.C., and the Pentagon. And if opposition is not enough, we must resist. And if resistance is not enough, then subvert. We can now see that Glen Canyon Dam was merely a step toward the urbanizing, industrializing, and probably the militarizing of the American West. But Glen Canyon Dam remains particularly painful and obnoxious to many of us. It is not only a symbol, but an exemplification of what greed and stupidity can do to the American land. Surely, no man-made structure in modern American history has been hated so much by so many for so long with such good reason as Glen Canyon Dam.
At this point in the historic afternoon, two cops showed up and started questioning the Earth Firsters, who shrugged their shoulders and pleaded innocence as Ed Abbey finished his speech.
Oppose, resist, subvert, delay until the empire itself begins to fall apart. And until that happens, enjoy. Enjoy the great American West, what's left of it. Climb those mountains, run those rivers, hike those canyons, explore those forests, and share in the beauty of wilderness, friendship, love, and the common effort to save what we love. Do this, and we'll be strong and bold and happy. We will outlive our enemies, and as my good old grandmother used to say, we'll live to piss on their graves. Thank you.
Back in Berkeley, we cut the footage into a 9-minute film called The Cracking of Glen Canyon Dam with Edward Abbey and Earth First, which was then screened for thousands of people throughout the West. In theater after theater that summer, at the moment the unfurling crack seems to reach its full extent, it erupts with new life and rolls down another 50 feet, and audiences burst into laughter and cheers. We had captured a catalytic moment and the birth of Earth First. And as each crowd celebrated, I experienced the power of film and the magic of having been in the right place at the right time. Our on-camera interview with Ed Abbey was one of the few he did in his lifetime. As fate would have it, one of the only other filmmakers to interview him on film was Jessica Abbey, not related to Ed, but who I ended up marrying a decade later and have been making films with ever since. During Jessica's interview in 1985, when he was in Berkeley celebrating the 10th anniversary reissue of the Monkey Wrench Gang, Abby made some thought-provoking points about civil disobedience, and Jessica has graciously agreed to share the highlights from her interview.
What about real events? And a lot of the monkey wrenching that they do in the book, they get away with.
Sounds pretty technical. Well, there was some field research involved in the creation of that book, yes.
Can you be more specific?
You think the statute of limitations has run out? Yeah, I did some night work, yes. I'll admit that I did it 10, 15 years ago.
Are there any specific incidents that you can think of monkey wrenching, either by Earth First or other people, that have really accomplished what they set out to accomplish? I mean, Earth First has certain political goals.
It's monkey wrenching is just a delaying tactic. In fact, I think the whole conservation movement is a delaying tactic. We're just trying to slow down the industrialization and urbanization of the country until we hope people come to their senses or enough political resistance can be organized to stop it, stabilize the human population.
Do you advocate it?
Advocate what?
Taking extreme measures like those.
Only as a last resort when all other means have failed. I regard defending the wilderness as something like defending your own home. I regard the wilderness as my home, my true ancestral home. And when it's being invaded by clear cutters and strip miners, I feel not only the right, but the duty, the moral obligation to defend it by any means I can. Writing letters to congressmen doesn't do it. And I am perfectly willing myself to go out and perform illegal actions. Civil disobedience, if that will help. And if that also fails, why then even more direct action. As long as no life is put in danger, I would distinguish between terrorism and sabotage. Terrorism is violence against living things, people and other animals. Sabotage is violence against machinery, property, which I am saying in certain extreme situations may be morally justified. It's not an easy argument to make. It gets awfully difficult and complicated, and I would not urge anyone else to mess around with it unless their conscience impels them to do so. We're proposing a return to basic principles of human life living in harmony with other forms of life on this planet. People on Earth First think that the big U.S. conservation organizations have compromised too much, and that it's time for an end to compromise, time for extreme and radical statements, at least from somebody. And I've always been happy to be an extremist and a radical myself, and I find it quite pleasing that there are thousands of other people who feel as I do.
You think there are thousands?
Including some really heroic types like Dave Foreman and Doug Peacock, and Wildcat Annie, and many others I should name, who are willing to put their bodies on the line to defend things they believe in, like trees, clear water, running rivers.
Edward Abbey departed the physical world on March 14, 1989, at the age of 62. But his spirit is very much alive, and we're still learning from him today. He gave us a lot to think about as we struggle to protect biological diversity and ecological integrity in the face of human arrogance and greed. Perhaps the most valuable teaching was that if we want to stay sane, our resistance needs to include humor, creativity, and regular enjoyment of nature. Since Ed Abbey left us, fossil fuel-induced climate chaos on the Colorado Plateau has resulted in a 25-year mega drought. Less snow in the mountains, less rain in the desert. As a result, the water level in Lake Powell behind Glen Canyon Dam has dropped below one-third of the reservoir's capacity. If the drought continues, as scientists predict it will, the dam will soon be unable to generate any electricity, one of the prime reasons for its existence. It's time to remove Glen Canyon Dam, free the Colorado River, and restore Glen Canyon. Thank you. Jessica Abbey has written a new novel about eco-activism in the forests of Northern California in the 1970s, titled Some Greater Awakening, a book very much inspired by Ed Abbey and Earth First. For a $200 donation to the Sacred Land Film Project, you will receive a signed copy of Jessica's novel. To make a tax-deductible donation, visit sacredland.org, or you can order the book at jessicaabbey.com. Tune into the next episode of Sacred Land Speaks for a rebroadcast of our story about the top doctor of the Winnemem Wintu and a fierce protector of Mount Shasta, Florence Jones. If you like what you've heard, please rate and subscribe to Sacred Land Speaks on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit sacredland.org to learn more about our films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Toby McLeod and Callie Shanafelt Wong. Our interview and film footage of Edward Abbey was recorded by Randy Hayes, Glenn Switkus, and myself. Jessica Abbey's interview was shot by Jim Hurwitz. Audio sweetening by Leroy Clark at Sirius Sound. Our theme music was composed and performed by Stefan Smith and Charles Johnson. Sacred Land Speaks is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in the Lajan Ohlone territory of Huchiun, otherwise known as Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.